Are we turned on? There we go. Okay. The secretary will note the attendance. A quorum is present. And the first item on our agenda today is Senator Betzold's Senate File 2645. And before we begin that, just for the people who are here in the audience, I want to let you know that we are going to, we have this committee room until 6 o'clock. We absolutely have to be done at least a little before 6 because Commerce is going to start in here at 6 sharp. The bill, the second bill on our agenda is the one that we are expecting to have the most people who want to testify, and we are going to finish that discussion by 5:30, no matter what, which is gives us a couple of hours, so I think we should have plenty of time, but we do need to get to the our third bill and be able to get through in time. So with that, Senator Betzold.
And thank you, Madam Chair, members. This actually is a bill that was introduced by Sarah Moy, but she's not available to be here today. I'm a co-author on the bill, so I'll be presenting it to you. This basically eliminates the requirement of a Social Security number in marriage dissolution proceedings. As we're aware that we have not only our state law, but we're trying to protect Social Security numbers from public dissemination. And the statute requires that a Social Security number be part of a petition for marriage dissolution. Now, the Minnesota Supreme Court has actually promulgated rules to say that so that it's not public, there can be a separate information which is not public, which is filed with the court, which is actually we are required to at least collect Social Security numbers information in by federal law in cases where there's going to be child support because the law requires that. So there are issues in here, but we believe that by just providing this and in concert with what the court provides, that would not only satisfy the federal law, but also take care of the issue of having Social Security numbers being public. I do have a witness here from the State Bar Association can further testify as to some of the background here. Glenn Norton.
Mr. Norton, would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, thank you. I'm Glenn Norton. I'm here on behalf of Minnesota State Bar Association. I'm the chairman of the Family Law Section's Legislative Committee, and we are proposing this bill. This is something we think is a necessary correction because to follow the letter of the law the way it is now, we're supposed to include those Social Security numbers in petitions. But if you go to the courthouse and look up someone's divorce file, you can read the petition in total. And so if that Social Security number is mandatory in the petition, what has to happen then is either a clerk or the attorney filing has to take a black magic marker and mark it off so that it isn't there when it goes into the court file. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court has promulgated Form 11.1, which requires that when you file the summons and petition, you list everyone's Social Security number so that when you're using an enforcement mechanism for child support and things, you have it there. But it's confidential for everyone but court personnel. So we have it covered if we remove it from the petition, is the bottom line.
Senator Limmer, do you have any questions?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold?
Well, it is not my bill originally, and I'm not a. When the notice went out, it was my name that was on the notice. I think Janet Marshall from the Supreme Court had some initial questions on it. I referred her to Senator Moy's office. But I got one overall question, Madam Chair, which I think might be of interest to the people here. In the past, we've had a data practices omnibus bill. I think we have relatively few bills this year. Was it the plan to just have the few bills go separately? Because I think the few bills we've got may have to go to other committees. So rather than put together a bill, what was the plan for this year?
Senator Betzold, the plan is that this year we're not planning to have an overall data practices omnibus bill. Senator Moy and I talked about this early on, and just because of the nature of the bills, there weren't a lot of technical amendments or things that there's only a few amendments to be made or changes to be made that were technical, and it just seemed more appropriate to have you carrying bills that you're specifically affiliated with. So that's the way we decided to do it.
Yes.
Is there anyone else in the audience who's here to testify specifically on this bill, Senate File 2645?
Madam Chair, if there is no further testimony on it, I will move on behalf of Senator Moore that Senate File 2645 be recommended to pass to the full Judiciary Committee.
Senator Betzold has moved that 2645 be recommended to pass to the full Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None. Motion passes. Now, Senator Betzold, I think you have Senate File 2345.
I do, Madam Chair, and this is a bill that was introduced towards the end of the 2007 session, requested by the Department of Administration to address a number of issues that they've received over the years that under current law that they wanted to clarify. Now, I do have an A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape that I would desire to move forward. This is the first time that this bill is considered, so I'd like to move the A1 amendment. I believe it's been part of the packets already, and I believe it's available for the public as well.
Senator Betzold has moved the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
And Madam Chair, in a moment I'll just ask Ms. Byer-Kropensky to describe some of the need for the bill, but let me just set the context here. There's two areas where the Data Practices Act raises a number of questions that Department of Administration, you know, has to answer questions, respond to, and those are civil investigative data, which I'll define further, and licensing data on state agencies. Civil investigative data is already addressed in state statutes. That is in the Data Practices Act. That is where the government is either bringing a lawsuit or defending a lawsuit, a civil legal action. Unlike other areas of data where government is just collecting and receiving data for some specific purpose, this is a little bit different because in this case, government actually has to get data, unlike just normal collecting it, we're using it for a specific purpose, that is to bring or defend a lawsuit. And so the kind of data that you collect, you know, may be different from that which we just receive because we're requiring people to disclose information to us. And so that's the kind of data that we're talking about, not really the collecting part. We also refer in statute to the when it can be released, and there's a lot of discretion that's given right now to what's called the government's chief attorney. And there really isn't a standard as to when that discretion can be exercised. Overall, there are times when the government can have data which it needs in the course of the lawsuit, which you need to share, which otherwise isn't public information, but you still have to share. For instance, if witnesses are being interviewed, you at least have to tell the witnesses what the investigation is all about and maybe even share some of the information that might not be public, but you may need to do that in order to talk to the witnesses. This also ties into licenses that are issued by state agencies. And we're talking about occupational licenses, not like fishing licenses from the DNR or maybe local licenses by local units of government. The Data Practices Act sets forth processes by which certain licensing information does not have to be public. As an example, when we did the stalking bills many years ago, we provided situations where a person did not have to list a home address as your license address as long as you provided another address. And there's other information that we've decided that could be non-public information, which is still going to be required to be provided to the government agency. What this does is extend some of these principles to businesses as well as individuals, because there are times when the business might actually need the similar protections under the same reasons that were provided to the individuals. That is an overview of the bill. Let me turn it over to Ms. Bauer-Krupinski, and she can go through some of the more details of the bill, and we can, and I know there's people who have issues, some which may have been resolved by the A1 amendment and others which may still have issues, but let me turn it over to her.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer-Krupinski.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Lori Bauer-Krupinski, Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at ADMIN. And when I came to ADMIN in 2004, my mission was really simple. I wanted to proactively change the Data Practices Act so that anyone who picked it up, citizen or government, could read it, understand it, and use it. And I thought, well, that won't take too long. Well, it's going to take quite a much longer. For everything, each year we change, there's something else that needs fixing. But in my work, these two sections are some of the more problematic ones. There's been a lot of overlap and confusion about them. And the more and more confusion you have, you wind up with government entities making different decisions, sometimes being conservative and risk-averse because they don't see a clear answer. And what we want them to have is more clear answers about what to do. Over the years, I've also been attending the Data Practices Subcommittee of the State Bar Association has meets to talk about common issues and brainstorm answers. And over the years, we continue to hear how these two sections are problematic, and everyone's kind of looking around the table saying, okay, who's going to take this on and fix it? Well, in addition to hearing their concerns, also our customers are struggling with how this works as well. So I asked a small group of government attorneys from the Data Practices Subcommittee of the State Bar Association to work on a draft that might get things a little clearer, some clearer bright lines between how these two sections interact. As Senator Betzel mentioned, this bill was introduced late to allow everyone to have lots of opportunity for feedback. Since it was really meant to clarify, I wanted to make sure that we heard from everyone because I didn't want to break something that wasn't broken or fix something that wasn't broken, and I wanted to really have any idea possible that would make these things clearer. So we have worked with a lot of people on this A1 amendment, including the Newspaper Association, the League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, state agencies, Education Minnesota, licensing boards, legal aid, the Civil Law Committee of the City Attorneys Association. So really anyone who had any feedback to give, we've been talking to about how to make these two areas work better together. And I'm going to go through and do kind of a quick overview of the bill, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dave Oren from the Department of Health and then Wendy Lake from the Department of Labor and Industry. And they will be much better able to give you concrete examples for how these sections are difficult as they work in their own agencies, because they have much more of the specifics of licensing both individual human beings as well as businesses and how that works.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer-Krupinski, but I'd also like you as you're, like, I would appreciate it as you're walking us through the bill, if you would not only just talk about the difficulties the agencies are experiencing, but if you could very clearly and concretely talk about the changes we are making in terms of the types of information that would have been public before that we are now classifying differently and basically limiting the public's access or preventing the public from having access to that information. If we can make sure, and I think that'll be helpful for some of our later testifiers too, so that we can maybe dispel any misunderstandings about what we're doing, but also make it clear, not just that we're making things easier to deal with, our sound better, our look better, but we are, I think, contemplating some real substantive changes here, and I want to make sure that those substantive changes are on the public record.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will do that, because part of this bill makes both more data elements public as well as protect some data that isn't protected now. So there is a blend in here. So I will highlight that as I'm going through. In Section 1 of the bill, as Senator Betzel mentioned, this current civil investigative data is limited to just data that's collected by a government entity, which doesn't make a lot of sense because when you get a complaint, you passively receive it. You don't really go out saying, hey, anyone have any complaints this week? You also, once you have a complaint, you start creating data. You start doing interviews with people, and you start trying to build a case to figure out, are you going to take some kind of an action? Are you going to commence a lawsuit, an administrative action, or not? So there is data that gets created, collected, disseminated, and maintained as a part of an investigation. And we want this section to mirror what's already in the Data Practices Act that says it doesn't matter how government gets it, it's still going to be government data. So that's one of the big changes here. And then with the benefit of Ms. Pontius.
So just to kind of slow down on that a little bit, so we're saying civil investigative data that used to be public information, so if someone wanted this information, would now become private information?
No, Madam Chair. This is a section of discretion where a chief attorney for a government entity already had the ability to declare data that would otherwise be public or private or not public as confidential and protected non-public. So they already had the discretion to be able to protect this data.
And Madam Chair, if you look on page 1, lines 11 and 12 of the A1 amendment, the stricken language says that that's current law. Whether an action is pending shall be determined. Well, excuse me, that's a different issue. But I'm sorry.
So what we do, and Ms. Pontius added, we also amend, we are striking the word pending and deleting whether a civil action is pending is a determination by the chief attorney. And instead what we've said is the decision to declare data, civil investigative data, still going to be made by the chief attorney, but now they have to have a reasonable basis on which to make that decision. Over the years, this is a huge area of discretion, and many government and many people in the public believe that government overuses this section and that sometimes chief attorneys just say, I decided, and that's it. And what we want is, no, if you really believe you're going to be commencing or defending a lawsuit, you really have to have some kind of a reasonable basis for saying that.
Senator Limmer?
On this first section, subdivision one, when we're talking of removing the word pending from the civil legal action definition or reference, does that mean then that all civil legal action would be considered classified in this manner? Whereas before, we're just making reference to just those civil legal actions that are pending. So anything past, maybe even an anticipation of something going on in the future, how far? This seems like it's rather an expansive definition now.
Ms. Beyer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I don't think it's an expansion because what we're trying to do is take the stricken language from lines 1.8 to 1.21. We move that up and expand that to include civil investigative data, however you get it. And then we also keep that same standard of the chief attorney makes the decision of whether or not they are collecting and protecting this data for commencement or defense of a loss of a civil legal action. So the standard is the same. You still get the same concept of you have to have some notice that something's going to happen.
And one other question I have, at
Senator
least for
Limmer.
Now. Thank you, Madam Chair. who would be the chief attorney for the government entity in this case?
Ms. Beyer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, that depends on which government entity. For a county board, it would often be their county attorney or a representative from their county attorney's office. Cities and school districts often contract with private attorneys to provide their legal services. Oftentimes, they have in-house legal counsel. State agencies have the attorney general's office and then also people who have delegated authority to act as the attorney for a state agency.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The question I see here is, at least in the language that has been stricken, you do have a reasonable determination, I guess, lack of a better term, standard. Mm-hmm. And if we have a different chief attorney for the government in a variety of different levels, are we going to be triggering a moving definition of what reasonable determination is at every level of government? And where would the public expect a standard that they could rely on if every chief attorney for a government entity may have a little definition of what reasonable determination means?
Ms. Beyer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think part of the reason to keep the decision with the chief attorney is that as officers of the court, we're bound by rules of professional conduct. So basically, we shouldn't be able to say something if it's just a bald-faced lie. We should have to have some reasonable basis for making a certain argument. But certainly, you're right that different attorneys feel more or less comfortable making certain arguments, and we're more conservative and more liberal. And part of the thing is to include some kind of a reasonableness standard because it's not there right now, and some people believe that it's just I decide and that's it. I can be arbitrary and capricious in making that decision.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, I think we need to stress what the current law is and how it's being changed, and I think that may put it in some context. As Ms. Barkopensky indicated, right now there is no standard. It's just if the attorney feels that it should or should not be released, that's the end of it. So saying that he has to have some reasons for it is important enough. If you look ahead to page 2, current law already on section 3 at the top of the page, current law provides a mechanism under which a person can bring an action in the county where it's maintained for disclosure of the information. So right now a person can you know, ask the court to have a release of information. And right now, the chief attorney says, well, I just don't think it ought to be released. That's the end of it. Now, with reason, with having a reasonable standard, they have to provide an explanation that's going to satisfy the court that the information should not be disclosed. Again, current law provides a mechanism for the disclosure, but the current law does not provide a standard by which the court can independently determine whether or not the information ought to be released. As for whether it's pending or not, I think the word pending probably refers to maybe an active case, something that's ongoing, as opposed to before it started. But if you look at Section 4, again, of current law, you know, there's a way that once the case is no longer is concluded, then the information becomes public. And so, you know, so I think that we're keeping the same concepts that are currently in law, saying that while the case is ongoing, there's a reason not to disclose information because, you know, you've got a lawsuit going on, and it may not be in the public's interest for the state to have to turn over all its information, you know, make it all public, which might actually defeat the whole purpose of the state's lawsuit or the state's defense. So this is still current law. I think we're just trying to clarify so that we have some bright lines here as to when it's public, when it's not public, and you know how to release it, and so forth. Again, these are not new concepts because this is current law.
Sure.
Senator Limmer?
I'm sure Senator Betzold, has the courts been petitioning the legislature to determine a direction on this area of law?
Well, Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the courts would not contact the legislature on this. The courts apply the law as we pass it. They're not here to give us advice as to what we should or shouldn't do. Obviously, if we pass a law that they think is unworkable, they will either strike it down or make some comment, you know, on the case that is presented to them on the case. But they don't hypothetically come to us and say, you know, you've got a statute that needs fixing. That's a separation of powers issue. Yeah,
but Senator Betzel, and just to follow up on Senator Limmer's comments, certainly there are cases where sometimes, you know, cases are brought to the court, and there may be some ambiguity or so forth, and they'll make a comment about if the legislature wants to speak on this issue, they will or they can or they could, and then sometimes we do, so they may not come to us directly, but if I understood Senator Limmer's question, I think he was asking more whether this has been an issue that the courts have had to deal with.
I guess I'd have to rely on witnesses who worked with these issues in court where there may have been requests for disclosure of information, and I think that might clarify that point.
And I'm sorry, Senator Limmer, I didn't mean to put words in your mouth, but did you have a follow-up or a question?
Well, I just was wondering if... if we're having the discussion of whether or not the courts can make judgment on the chief attorney for the government's reasonable determination, then it's probably a sliding scale for the courts as well to try and determine whether we're relying on existing law or this new law we haven't really given a clear standard to the judges either, are we? We're just kind of shuffling the deck chairs, and the courts will still have we'll have to rely on their discretion in order to determine what reasonable determination is. And I guess that's the question that I'm asking is, you know, whether the courts are they relying on a standard to make their decision? And how does the public arrive at what might be an appropriate standard as well? If you have a number of different chief attorneys for the government that are representing the government, so now they're representing a client interest, and they're the ones that are going to make the determination of whether or not it's reasonable or not to release information?
Senator Bitzel?
Well, everything has to be decided in the context of whatever the issue is presented before the judge. Is it going to be somebody's going to be challenging something, saying, you know, there should be information released, and they're going to have to make their argument as to why they think the information should not be withheld. And the chief attorney is actually going to have to give some explanation, some reasons why, you know, why he does not think it ought to be released. As I say, today he can just trump it by saying, I don't think it ought to be released. End of the case. Now he's going to have to come up with a reason. Now, there's a myriad of cases that can possibly come on up because there's all kinds of lawsuits that can be where the state is sued or being sued. And I don't think we could come up with any kind of a standard that's going to match every one of those cases. Not, you know, you mentioned the chief attorneys and the judges. I mean, there's just all kinds of the litigants and so forth. But, you know, at some point, if the judge makes a decision that the parties don't agree with, there's always the appellate courts that can always step in and decide whether or not the decision of the judge was correct in applying a reasonable standard. Deciding what is reasonable is something that vexes, you know, the best of law professors and law students and judges and so forth, trying to strike that balance between disclosure and not disclosure in this case.
Senator Bitzel, and maybe we're going to get to this. I'm going to suggest that we get through the bill, allow the testimony, and then maybe have some discussion to make sure that everyone gets it. Well, I'm sure we're going to want to have discussion, but maybe some of our questions will be answered and clarified for us as we listen to the testimony. And I do want to give everyone a chance to have their say.
Madam Chair, one of the things this is doing back to Section 2 is once that chief attorney's made the decision, the Data Practices Act says you can't share data unless you have statutory private or confidential data unless you have statutory authority. So what we build in here is an extension of the authority to share this data, that is civil investigative data, to aid the investigative process. So as Senator Bitzel mentioned, how do you have conduct an interview with a witness if you can't at least share some of the data about the allegations? And then also to very explicitly say that at some point the Constitution trumps your ability to withhold data, and that at some point someone needs to be able to exercise their due process rights, and you need to be able to share data with the subject of the investigation so that they can defend themselves. So we expressly allow the government entity to make the decision that those data need to be shared to allow for those things to occur. But then we, of course, limit the data can't be shared if it's subject of a protective order of a judge or an administrative law judge. So we allow the court to protect data as well. And then we also, one of the areas that we are extending more access is right now a complainant can get back their own statement, even though it's confidential. The complainant can get back their own statement, but witnesses and the subject of the investigation can't. And we allow that to happen now. So that is an instance where more data will be available to the subject of the data than current law. In Section 3, we're just making a grammatical change. And then Section 4, we have that any data that becomes part of the court or an Office of Administrative Hearing is public, except for protective orders, court rules, and other laws. So that would allow, once you've gone through the administrative procedure, you have a final outcome, but there are Social Security numbers in there, or there is the identity of someone who made a complaint in there, that still allows for that data to get redacted even in those proceedings. Section 5, we move into the business.
Senator Bitzel, or Senator Limmer, I'm sorry, has a question.
I had you stepped over one item on page 1 of the A1 amendment down on lines 34 and 35, I believe you've included an administrative law judge function in this, and I don't believe that's part of existing law, is it? And I was wondering if maybe you could expand why an administrative law judge is now introduced into this legislation.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, this is introduced because we're allowing for more data to be shared, for the government to decide to share more data with witnesses and the subject. We also wanted to make it clear, too, that if a judge says you can't share it, then you're not going to. And if that judge is an administrative law judge, that will count the same, because these are often proceedings that are going before an administrative law judge in a contested case hearing. But we just wanted to make sure that even though we're giving them more authority to share this data, that if some kind of a judge is saying you won't do it, of course you're not going to do it.
Senator Limmer, does that answer your question?
Well, I think it explains why, or the logic of having administrative law judges there. But again, it goes back to the standards of how we're writing our law, and now we're allowing a number of administrative law judges to individually interpret each and every case. And it's a little different. We have the ability in the legislature to make policy. And why aren't we making policy that's standardized across the board? And hopefully that'll come clearer as we get into this discussion more. But I'm just wondering why a separate administrative law judges are being introduced to this system.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, if you look back to lines 1.10 and 1.11, a civil legal action is already defined to include administrative and arbitration proceedings, so they are already a part of current law. It's not extending it beyond the state of the current law.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, I think, at least in my mind, Senator Limmer's concern goes to the reasonable determination standard and what constitutes reasonable, and not having that determination interpreted differently by different judges, whether they're ALJs or whomever they may be. And I have to say that I share that concern, having dealt with some other kinds of situations when I was trying to get information when I was representing people who were injured in accidents, and trying to get information from the county attorney's office, where they had some discretion to determine whether they were going to provide that information or not. And generally the discretion was just exercised in the way that they just never provided it. So I have some concerns about that too, if there isn't a little bit more of a firm some standards that they would have to delineate, instead of just something that broad in general. But I do want to let you go on so that we can get through the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, and also if you look at lines 2.6 to 2.11, it describes current law for what a person does if they disagree and want to have access to data that the chief attorney has made, civil investigative data. It says they can go to court, and then it provides a standard for the court to say they can order that all or part of the data be released to the public or the person when they make a decision whether or not the benefit to the person bringing the action to the public outweighs the harm that's going to be done. So that's the standard you already have in current law that administrative law judges and judges are supposed to apply when someone says, hey, no, I want this data. Please release it to me. Please order that this data be released to me.
Thank
you. But, Madam Chair, you are correct in that every attorney and every judge has their own set of, no two people are alike, and, of course, we all have our different ways of how we would gauge that kind of discretion and behavior.
And honestly, Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, for the average citizen to have to go to court to enforce something like this is putting a pretty heavy burden on that person. But please go ahead.
Okay. But, Madam Chair, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have the government entity allowed to share for due process, because I don't think someone should have to go to court to get data to defend themselves if the government entity says, no, it's confidential, sorry, you can't get it, get a court order. I think that there should be some sharing. So I agree with you that citizens have to have some other vehicle versus going to court. Now, Section 5 is where we start to get to the big changes in the licensing data section. And what we do, right, the biggest change is to really hone in and make the definition about occupational, trade, and professional licenses so that we don't, anything else that's called a license isn't what we're talking about. It's one that's issued by a state agency, so the Nursing Board, the Department of Health, the Department of Labor and Industry, and it's one that you must have to be able to perform an occupation or a trade. I mean, I can grow things in my backyard, or I can have a cow in my backyard, but I can't sell milk unless I have some kind of a license from the Department of Agriculture. So we wanted to really get at a very smaller subset, because there are folks who have read this and said, isn't my recreational fishing license the same thing as covered by this? So we want to make it clear that it's a smaller pool of data than people might get from reading this. And we also clarify that it only applies to state agencies, because the way the current language read, many local units of government, both city and county, read the language and thought that it included the kind of licensing that they might do for building permits or liquor licenses. So we wanted it to be as crystal clear as possible that this was only state agency issued licenses. Section 6 of the bill is where we extend the protection for business to businesses for licensed data.
Actually, it's 7.
Oh. Is it section 7? Okay.
She did 5.
Did I skip 5?
No, you did it.
Okay.
Administrative hearings.
Yep. So what we do is extend, right now what we have is if I'm an individual human being, I'm an individual chiropractor who needs to be licensed by the Board of Chiropractic. Data about me is going to be protected. While I'm an applicant, the only data that's going to be public about me is my name and my designated address. So for a short period of time, everything about me except for those two things is protected. Once I get my license, everything in my application is public. But then, let's say 5 years down the road, someone complains about me. That data we then is going to be civil investigative data. But if I were a business, I wouldn't get that same protection. So what this does is that big policy shift to say, aren't there instances where businesses should be entitled to some of the same protections as individual human beings get?
So again, just to clarify, to put this into concrete examples, when there are complaints against businesses, they would have the same protection that individuals have now. If the complaints are not substantiated, they would no longer be available to the public. Is that basically what this does?
Madam Chair, yes. For those unsubstantiated complaints where no discipline is imposed by the licensing agency. And then also what you see in this, in Section 7, is we add additional data elements that are public about applicants, both people and businesses. Because right now I told you those only the name of the applicant and their designated address are public. So we add some data elements so that, you know, kind of the license period for which you're applying, as well as whether or not you have an approved application or disapproved, withdrawn, or pending. So we make additional data elements about those applicants public. Because right now if someone says, hey, is someone licensed, you can say they've applied and that's all you can say. So we wanted to have more data out there that was public. And then we start to make those corresponding changes where you'll see the reference on line 3.25 to section 1339, where we start to say, okay, the identity of complainants that aren't maintained in anticipation of litigation under 1339. So you start to see better cross-references between these two sections. And then at lines 3.27, you get the nature and content of unsubstantiated complaints, if there's no discipline or penalty imposed, is going to be private data or non-public data about that licensee. And then we, at lines 3.31, we are repealing language that is already taken care of by 1339. And continue to make the corresponding changes we need to do to extend this to both individual human beings and businesses. What you see then in Section 8 is we are repealing some language down below, and we have moved a portion of it that's subject to the post board so that it's all right there. All the post board is in the same section. that details what's public about peace officers. But that's already current law. We're just moving it. And then when we get to Section 9, we do the corresponding changes to reference not public data, so that includes both individuals and not on individuals. And then what we're doing is changing the standard that was current law was you could release data if there was a clear and present danger to public health or safety. And what we do is instead use the same sharing authority that we have in 1339. So you can share data if it will aid law enforcement in investigative process, allow for due process, promote health and public safety, and dispel widespread rumor and unrest. So we get the same standard in both sections, which I think is important to do. And then in a crucial piece in Section 10, we say all investigations of licensees is handled by 1339. So at some point, you get this complaint. It becomes civil investigative data under 1339. At some point, it becomes inactive. It comes back again to this to be covered by 1341. So then you figure out when the civil investigation is done, was someone disciplined? Was the complaint substantiated? If it was, it's all public. If it wasn't, it's private. And then you also have then the identity of the person who complained is still going to be private even in the inactive investigation. So you see these two sections going back and forth and better coordination between the two, hopefully. And then what you'll see in the repealer is we repeal sections of old law or existing law that were partial misstatements of the general presumption that everything's public. And what we continue to see is every time you have any kind of a partial list of here's some stuff that's public, people think nothing else is. So what we've done is be really clear about when things are not public and repealed all the language that was a partial restatement of the presumption. We don't want people to be confused. We just want them to know what data is protected and that everything else is then public. So it's just cleaner and people don't get as confused.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Byer-Kopensky. Sure. Oh, Senator Limmer?
Thank you. I wanted to ask one question. There's a kind of an unusual use of words. I've never seen it in state statute, but page 4, line 26, the reference to or to dispel widespread rumor or unrest. Now, can you explain where that reference ever came from?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky?
Madam Chair, Senator Loomer, that is already an existing law somewhere else, and I think it's actually in the criminal investigative statute. And it's just, I think it's just such a great phraseology, and I was just like, hey, let's repeat it. Because I just think widespread rumor and unrest, it gives you the sense of, you know, you should be sharing this because you've got a really good reason. But I'm certain Mr. Gemberling's here, and he could probably tell you more information about that, but it's already repeated in an existing law, and I just think the phrase is interesting to use again.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Ms. Byer-Kopensky, I was going to reserve my comments till we get to the overall discussion of the bill, but I would just say that it seems to me in that particular section, Section 9, Subdivision 6, we're really making quite a huge leap or change from existing law, from taking information that would be normally classified as confidential or private, which we're now calling non-public. And before, the only way that could be released is if it was likely to create a clear and present danger to the public health or safety. That's a pretty high standard. And we're now basically almost eliminating standards, just saying if it's going to aid them in almost any way. It's that there's a lot of discretion in the language that we're putting there and making a very substantive change. So I just want to comment on that.
And Madam Chair, if you think about it, we used 1341 licensing used to have data like confidential data as well. We've repealed that and said the only confidential data you have is in civil investigative data. So now the only data that would be subject to the release for this different standard is private or non-public data. So data that you know I get to have access to because it's about me. So I think it makes sense to have the same standard applied in both sections, especially when the data is typically seen as, since it's not confidential or protected non-public, it's less sensitive.
Well, why don't we, do we have other testifiers here that want to kind of expand on your comments? I think David Oren and Wendy Leggy are listed as witnesses. Did they want to testify?
And, Madam Chair, Mr. Oren had to go, so now Wendy Legg is going to make comments for both her and the Department of Health.
Okay.
So it'll be, but thank you, and I'll also be here for questions as well.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today. My name is Wendy Legg, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I'm a construction codes and licensing attorney, and I was hired as part of that after the Consolidation Act that moved various trades, the regulation of various trades and licensing of trades over to the Department of Labor and Industry. I've been at the department since 2005, and I've held other positions within state government for over 20 years. And for more than 15 years, part of my job has been to advise state agencies on data practices issues, including how to interpret the sections that are at issue today, the civil investigation and licensing data sections. These sections are very confusing and difficult to apply, even for someone like me with more than 15 years of experience in trying to understand them. The department strongly supports the Delete All Amendment. These amendments would help clarify these sections and would also fix some problems with the sections as currently written. Now, I know Mr. Oren is not here to speak for the Health Department's support of this bill, but I did work with Mr. Oren and members of other state agencies on the group that Ms. Byer-Krupinski mentioned that created, went through various problems with these sections and tried to come up with language that would help clarify the sections and help deal with some of the issues that are raised. So I feel comfortable in saying that Mr. Oren would have spoken in support of this bill were he here today. And in fact, I can give some examples also that relate to the Health Department since I used to work for the Health Department before I worked for Labor and Industry. First, what I'd like to speak to are the amendments in Section 1339. As Ms. Byer-Krupinski said, the proposed amendments would cover more than just data collected. And I wanted to point out the specific language here. If you look at line 1.18, the words data collected or deleted, it only says data collected there. And Ms. Byer-Krupinski is and Senator Betzold are trying to add here lines 1.16, data collected, created, received, maintained, or disseminated. That's the distinction. Okay, and that's an important distinction because in performing investigations, departments do more than just collect data. If a complaint comes in the mail, that's not something the department has gone out and collected. That's data received. If the investigator writes down investigative notes, that's not something collected. That's something created. So as Ms. Byer-Krupinski said, it's reasonable to use the same language here that is used in other parts of the Data Practices Act so that it's not just limited to data collected. The next point I'd like to make has to do with these lines that 1.28 through 1.30. Perhaps before I get to the underlying language, I'd like to point out really in response to the final question from the chair as to why there's this language about aiding law enforcement process in 1341. If you look at lines 4.24 through 4.26, where it said create a clear and present danger to public health and safety, the reason that needs to be changed is so that the standards will be the same in 1339 and 1341. Where that language came from to spell white rumor or unrest, that's existing language in 1.30. In fact, all this bill tries to do is make the language the same. Again, consistency is very important for attorneys like me who are trying to interpret the law and advise our client agencies on how to apply it. That's why that is important, I would submit. Okay, then in terms of the underlined language, lines 1.28 to 1.29, it is critical that we add the release of data is permitted if it's will aid the investigative process of the government entity because we can't investigate without releasing some data. If someone sends in a photograph, for example, of a job that's been poorly done by a plumber or electrician or whatever, and we go out there and we see it's no longer like that, we need to be able to show the photograph and say, does this represent the work the way it was? We have to be able to show that so that we can find out, is this complaint accurate or not? So we need to be able to share that investigative data as part of the investigative process. In terms of allowing for the exercise of due process rights, I can give an example that spans both the Department of Health and the Department of Labor and Industry. As you know, plumbing used to be regulated at the Department of Health when I worked there. Plumbing is now regulated by the Department of Labor and Industry. One of the enforcement tools in that area, and now in all of the construction codes and licensing area, is an administrative order that can include a penalty. So, for example, let's say the Department of Labor and Industry finds a violation by a plumber that the department determines that we think warrants the assessment of a penalty. We would issue an administrative order, including a penalty of up to $10,000. But after we issue that order, the plumber has 30 days to appeal. Now, while the appeal is pending, that is not a public order. That's made clear in the case law. That is not a public order while the appeal is pending. But while the appeal is pending, the plumber asks us, well, how did you come up with that penalty? And we have to be able to show the plumber our analysis, the grid that we use to figure out the details as to how we came up with the penalty, so that plumber will have a better idea of whether to appeal or not. If we make that plumber appeal first and file with the court first so that everything's public before we share the information, that hurts the plumber. The plumber doesn't have the information that's needed in order to make a decision whether to spend the time and money appealing this order. So that's allow the exercise of due process right. That helps the regulated parties. It clarifies it for the government, but it helps the regulated parties. The government's not asking for something here. That helps the party. I have one more area that I'd like to testify about, and that is Section 13.41. And Ms. Beyer-Krupinski has already talked about how the proposed language would include businesses as well as individuals in 13.41. Now, currently Section 13.41 only addresses individual licenses, not business licenses. And the reason that that's always been interpreted that way for as long as I've been working in the Data Practices Act is because the current law uses the terms private. Private is a term that can only be used for an individual. So this whole language, this whole section 13.41, can only be about individual licensees. Because businesses that are licensees, no data is private about a business. They're not an individual. Okay, so that's where we start from in this section. 13.41, as currently interpreted by the Department of Administration, and it's historically interpreted for as long as I've been involved in data practices, has been viewed as applicable only to individuals. That's a problem. And that's a problem because some of the trades regulated by the Department of Labor and Industry require both a business license and an individual license. The business license would be governed by 1339 right now. The individual license by 1341. Now, I'd like to give some concrete examples here so you'll understand more of what I'm talking about. For electrical work, in order for electrical work to be performed, two licenses are required. First, there needs to be a business license. That license can be held by an individual, but it also could be held by a corporation, a partnership, limited liability, any form of business entity can hold it. In fact, usually the business license is not held by an individual. So you need a business license to do electrical work, but also there needs to be an individual who holds either a master electrician license or a power limited technician license. that individual needs to be a full-time employee of the business that holds the business license. So let's take an example. John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc. It's a corporation. It holds a business. This is obviously a fictional example, just to make clear. I'm not talking about any specific company. Let's say, for example, that business holds a business license, an electrical business license, which is actually called a contractor license. They would have to have at least one full-time employee with the required individual license. So John Doe himself could hold the master electrician license, and he could be the only electrician employed by John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc. So you have a little tiny company, John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc. Only electrician in it is John Doe. Okay. But there'd be two licenses.
Ms. Legg, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but to give everyone else a chance who wants to testify and then allow some time for discussion, I'm just going to have to limit you to about two or three more minutes, and then I'm going to have to move on or we're going to run out of time.
Okay. Okay. Well, let me just explain why there are two problems with John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc. license differently than John Doe's individual license. First, it's sometimes very difficult to figure out how to apply the law. If a complaint comes in against John Doe's Electric, is that a complaint against a business, or is that a complaint against an individual? As a practical matter, it'll probably be investigated as a complaint against both. So how do you divide the data? Which is the business and which is the individual? But it also, here's the big issue I want to point out. It creates a fairness problem. As a practical matter, electricians who work for a big company get more privacy protection than electricians who work for their own small company. So, for example, complaint comes in. John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc. We investigate it. We find it is totally unsubstantiated. That is a complaint against a business, not an individual. That unsubstantiated complaint becomes completely public, and everybody knows we're really talking about John Doe. On the other hand, let's say we got Jane Doe. Jane works for a big electrical company called ABC Company. A complaint comes in against ABC Company, and it's really about work Jane Doe did. When the complaint becomes public about ABC Company, That's okay. But if the complaint comes in against Jane Doe personally as an individual, then that's going to stay not public. The complaint against Jane Doe, if it's unsubstantiated, does not become public. It protects Jane Doe. Nobody will know that there was a complaint against Jane Doe. But the one that came against John Doe's Electrical Company, Inc., everybody will know about that complaint.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. At this point, we have four names of people who've asked to be heard, and I'm certainly going to try to give you as much time as possible, but I'd really like it if you could each limit your comments to, say, 5, 6, 7 minutes, something like that, and then I think we'll get through everyone. Unless, you know, we're interrupting you with questions that cause it take longer, we'll give you enough time to finish what you wanted to say. If you can help to point to specific things in the bill as you're going through this, then we can follow along with you. So we have Mr. Neumeister, Mr. Unlin, Mr. Anfinson, and Mr. Gruberling. If you'd all like to come up. And if we don't have everyone, here comes Mr. Neumeister. Yes, would you please? And is there anyone else in the audience who had wanted to testify about this bill, either pro or con? Because these are the only names I have. So if there's anyone else who had wanted to testify, would you please make sure that I have your name? Mr. Neumeister, we'll begin with you then.
Oh, you just give me a second here.
Okay.
Okay, I didn't know. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. This is more than just a clarification kind of thing and, you know, just putting the P's and Q's together. This is major. This is substantial. As someone who's followed the Data Practices Act for a number of years, before I came over, I went to the 1982 chapters. 1341 has been on the law books since 1982. Chapter 1339 and the issue of what is pending has been on the books since 1982 also. I believe they may have happened in 1981. So this is something that we've been living with for about 27 years. So I just want to, as a courtesy, to share that with you. Secondly, since that time, there have been a number of court decisions and opinions, over 600 opinions, and roughly I've gone through a lot of them over the past few weeks. I'd say about 5 to 8% of them are dealing with 1339 and 1341 issues. So there is guidance out there by the commissioner. I also want to share with you two major court cases that relate to some of these issues, and they relate from a citizen's interest, not necessarily looking from the state interest, but citizen's interest. Almost 20 years ago, the news media, KSTP, wanted access to health inspection records of restaurants. Some of the arguments that the city at that time were saying, that's, you know, civil investigative data, it's under 1339, whatever. A district court decision came down and basically said, hey, is it pending? Is it imminent? Is it, you know, all those kinds of things? No. Give them the health inspection reports. Now, I've been trying to get a hold of that district court opinion. It's not published. I asked the Minnesota Broadcasters Association if they could dig that up. Another case happened. It's a Baldwin family, and some people who have been around may know this because this family came and testified. There was a young man who had some discussion with a principal at a school. Something happened in that issue where the kid went out and then decided to kill himself. And what happened is the individual, the parents, wanted to get access or information or anything written about those things. And what you'll see in opinions and other kinds of things, 1339 always pops up. Well, we can't do that for this reason and for that. And that person had to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to go to court. Now, since 1993 and previously, now this, we're getting into the part of the bill that's so important, is that there is pending. Pending is starting to be defined as imminent. If you go to any Black's Law dictionary, if you go to any other dictionary, legal dictionary, it's very clear. It's imminent. And I think with lowering the standard to reasonable, it gets into the murkiness. Well, I think it's reasonable that there will be some kind of lawsuit. If you look at some of the opinions, and I can highlight points, there are very specific points that have been made. Now, whether or not public attorneys are willing to take a look at what the opinions say, that's their choice. But it's very clear as to what becomes, a way to do it and what becomes pending. So, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I would recommend keep pending in here. Do the legislature decided for a reason why to only deal with collected rather than the others. That was a legislative policy. It even led to a court case, St. Peter Herald versus City of St. Peter, or the other way around. And I noticed that in the proposed provision on 1819, that little thing is carved out to save that court decision to where notice of claims are non-public. So, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I encourage you to keep pending. I encourage you to define it. I encourage you to do what you currently have now, which has been a working definition. I highlighted, it's highlighted in opinions, and I don't want to waste the time to get into that, but I can cite to what those opinions are. Now, going down on page 1.33 and 1.34, I do have some concerns about that, to where now we're telling, it's basically pretty clear, we're saying, well, you can have access, but then an administrative law judge or whatever can decide, well, we're not going to give you access. It's always been very clear that the individual, at least the complainant under current law, is able to be able to have access to that. Again, in Subdivision 3, you're lowering the standard. Subdivision Section 5. I mean, one of the things that I remember, some of the things we have, what we call a traveling classification part of state statute. So if, you know, if it goes within entities or whatever, it retains that. And we even passed last year when data goes from one entity, like the state executive or whatever, and goes over to the judicial or vice versa, it shall retain its same classification. And this was done as an amendment, I believe, to the Data Practices Act. I think, and that's the other point, is what is the authority that administrative law judges have the ability to seal records? I give you a policy in 1339, under subdivision 3, where it says inactive investigative data. In that section, it says, any civil investigative data presented as evidence in court or made part of a court record shall be public. Very explicit. That's the policy of the legislature. And it's been around, I'll say, at least for 20 years. Because some things were added in the through 82, 83, 84 on the civil investigative line. Now, one of the things that we talk about now is 1341, and as I indicated to you, for 27 years, and it's been like that, private means, data on individuals. That definition has been there as long as I've been around. And so it's very clear that businesses, more information about businesses, are able to be public. Now, let me give you some examples of some of the opinions and some of the things that people were interested in. Over the years, people were interested in an opinion about what is the Board of Electricity. Patrick Howe, who was a reporter for the Associated Press, wanted to know the kinds of complaints that were done against pharmacies, not pharmacists, but pharmacies as a business. One of the things that there were some people who were interested, who went to the Minnesota Higher Ed Services, wanted to know all the trade correspondence, business trading correspondence. Individuals wanted access about information about some of the things that they regulate. If you go to the website, to the North Star portal, and look under license and permits and regulated activity, you got 24 pages of all kinds of things that can deal with that. Now, the person from labor and industry talked about electrical. You know, I can point out very specific, and if you get in detail. The other thing that I have concern, so I encourage you to keep it public. The other thing that I have concerns about is the referring to 1339 in a number of these things, and then the repeal. 1339, I think, with the lowering of the standards, which is murky now, I think and will even be more murkier, by saying that repealing of subdivision 5, what is public data, things that would be very, I think, very clearly public data, may somehow, some way, may not be, as it's intertwined in interpretation of 1339. So in summary, Madam Chair, this is a substantive change. This is no clarification. And all I can encourage is think about the citizens aspect of this and how at least government folks can do all kinds of things, and that 3, we're not in a rush on this. As was said, state attorneys all got together and did their thing. I think maybe to get a number of stakeholders all together and take a look at the broad issue and then come back with some changes and all that rather than be in the rush. Madam Chair, thank you for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And I just want to ask you a quick question here before you go, because this is something that concerns me, and you know, we're, as you pointed out, we're slashing the references to pending. And in the beginning, under subdivision 1, I'm not as concerned about that. If we were, because civil legal action, because we have subdivision 3 on line 2.14 that basically says once a civil investigation is inactive, that this information is public, except What it does also say is we're also taking out the pending there as well on line 2.16, so that it isn't, you can keep this information private either by saying that your investigation is no longer active, and sometimes these investigations I know go on for a long period of time, or just that they might jeopardize another civil legal action, not necessarily one that's pending, but it could just be one that some is in someone's mind that might someday come up somehow, some way. And there's really no standard at all there for that. And so to me, that means that there's an awful lot of discretion that would be able to be used to keep this information private almost indefinitely. For example, if we have information related to a bridge and what happened with a bridge, and we don't know for sure that there might not be problems with other bridges later on, even though there isn't an active case pending, we could use that as a reason not to release the information, and it might be critical information that the public would want to know. So I have that concern with that interaction as well. Let's see. I'm not sure, sir. Are there any other questions for Mr. Neumeister by Senator Lemur or Senator Betzel? Okay, then we have Mr. Is it Unlin? Okay. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'm really going to, I should have said something sooner to Mr. Neumeister, but we do want to let everyone get through. So if you can try to keep it to about 5 minutes, I'd really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you. One of my first concerns with this change in this law having to do with the data that is either collected, created, or received, becoming civil investigative data. And what I want to do is kind of look back at where some of this data may initially be collected or created before any anticipation of anything. And I'm going to speak from a color of law perspective, law enforcement personnel, detention personnel, people in the judiciary as prosecutors, et cetera. On the street, somebody might get pulled over and arrested, and the police officer may have a camera or recorder running. And the police officer may overstep his bounds and taser somebody who's handcuffed, or somebody in jail, like I was, may be subjected to 3+ hours of absolute horrible, agonizing pain. And not be able to get that data. If the chief legal authority says, ooh, gee, if we release the jail video and audio to Mr. Undlin, he'll actually be able to prove and show what happened, and he'll actually be able to fight for his rights under either civil action or under criminal action. I've spent the last almost 2 years trying to use the information that I received to convince appropriate authorities to do a criminal investigation.
Mr. Unlin, you understand that this doesn't apply to criminal investigative information.
Here's what I'm saying,
okay,
though. What happens is that the agencies, the political subdivisions who protect their own and don't want to go across the very thick blue line will avoid criminal investigation and initiate civil investigation. I was actually told with the first conversation that I had with a Hennepin County person, I wasn't told in this conversation, but later by him, that the county began looking at the likelihood that I was going to commence legal action against the county the day I asked for my video, July 17th, 2006. In October, when I talked with this person, he advised me to file a pending legal claim form because they're due within 6 months, which I did. My first mission has always been to hold people criminally accountable for the crimes they committed in that jail. If I didn't have that data to tell my initial story, it would be very, very easy for investigators, prosecutors, internal affairs, everybody deny that what happened happened. The only reason I can stand strong on what I know happened is because I have the data. I have the truth. I don't have all of it because they edited it, they muted out certain things, they covered their backsides in certain ways, they abused data practices law by claiming that they were protecting other people's private data when in fact that's not the case in two different ways. One being the jail data is by definition and incarceration data is by definition
Mr.
public.
But
what happens is that public data all of a sudden becomes as simple as an attorney saying, a chief attorney saying, well, I'm afraid you might commence legal action. And therefore, from the get-go, we're not going to let you get the information. It won't show up on the Channel 5 news. It won't show up on a blog. I will keep you from getting the data you need to even make your case. We're going to force you to rely on your memory instead of the recorded stuff that happened, and we're going to just, you know, let you try to make your case in the dark while they have all of the data. They will move to protect themselves. They will move to protect their own. They will not move unless forced to by court, as this, you know, clearly shows, is that I can go to court to force it potentially. That costs money, more time, more effort for things which have been identified in the past as being public, now being subject to the whims of a chief attorney.
Okay.
It's horrible.
I Mr. Under, I think you made a valid point, and I'm going to just ask that we hear from our other witnesses so that we have some time for those points to be addressed and discussed. And we will ask for some testimony back from the departments about how that might change under circumstances like yours, if we're doing anything that would change those circumstances. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
PC, Jeff Connell. Okay. We have Mr. Anfinson and Mr. Gruberling.
It's Gamberling, ma'am.
I'm sorry. Can you pronounce that for me one more time?
Gamberling.
Okay.
I thought it was Gruberling.
If I can say it's not her problem in understanding, it's my problem in how I write.
Okay. Well, Mr. Gamberling, would you like to be up next?
Sure. Why not? I know most
Just people, first identify yourself, please, for the record.
I'm about to. I know most people in the room, and I think most people in the room know me, except I don't know you. My name is Don Gamberling. For 34 odd years, I was the resident go-to person about data practices until I retired a few years ago. Okay. I can say with what I hope is a certain amount of modesty, nobody has written more about the Data Practices Act. Nobody has trained more people about the Data Practices Act. Nobody has talked more about the Data Practices Act than I have. Okay. And I kind of lay back and for a number of reasons, not show up here, okay? Because I think life ought to go on. But every once in a while, a role that you once assigned to me, that the legislature gave me, and which I accepted somewhat grudgingly, was to play the role of helping you not step into something you don't want to step into. And most of that has to do with law of unintended consequences. Mr. Anfinson either insulted me or paid me a great compliment by saying, the problem with data practices stuff, it is very dense stuff. And there are only about six or seven or eight people in the room or in the world who understand our statute. Okay? And I happen to be one of them. And most of you, frankly, aren't that expert. We don't expect you to be that expert. But what I would hope is that when people come before you, they help you make the most informed decision that you can make. I'm a great fan of Jack Davies' rule that the legislature never makes a bad decision. Well, usually there's laughter when that's said. So I just want to make a few comments about the bill that's in front of you. the potential unintended consequences that I see with the bill, and I have a lot of them, and I'll try and cut down on what I see. Part of what you're hearing is there is confusion about what these two statutory provisions mean. As Mr. Neumeister has pointed out to you, these two statutory provisions have been on the books for years. They have been the subject of any number of commissioner opinions. As the former Senator Gene Merriam's once said, in talking about why you give the Commissioner of Administration the authority to issue opinions, is you're letting the commissioner do that to help eliminate confusion. So a number of the points that you've heard today have been addressed in opinions. And you may disagree with what the commissioner said, and everybody could do that, but those points have been made, and answers have been provided. An example of that is there confusion about whether or not this licensing section applies to state agencies or political subdivisions? The answer is it applies only to state agencies. Why is that? Because that's what you decided all those years ago. Now, I sat in at least three times on meetings with local government folks who were trying to decide whether or not they wanted to come forward and get a licensing section just for them. And each and every time we had those meetings, they decided ultimately not to do that. Now, I don't know why. It was their call. I was there to offer them technical assistance. But this bill now will extend that. And I'm not quite, or it won't extend it. It clarifies an issue that's already been clarified. Okay? Now, the issue of licensing data applying to businesses. When the licensing section was first created, it was created solely to deal with individuals. That was its function. Okay, the bill now takes the licensing section and extends it to all businesses. But I think, and this is one of those things that I'm really worried about from an unintended consequence perspective, you have countless statutory sections that already deal with licensing of business. The Department of Commerce statutes are full of that kind of stuff. So what's going to apply? This new language or the old language? Okay. Now, from Commerce's perspective, I'm going to suspect that they want their old language. But now you have suggested the possibility that, you know, the new language is going to apply to all licensees. And what difference does it make? Well, the treatment of licensees in the Commerce section is very detailed. Okay? It's not just a couple of pages. It's page after page after page. And when I used to meet with them and say, you know, why don't you just bring all of this into licensing, they'd say, no, we don't want to do that. We've got too many variables, okay, because of the type of licensing we want to do. Now, one of the things you've heard is we got to be consistent, okay? Well, you know, I'm cursed with a liberal arts education. You know, Mr. Emerson did say that a foolish consistency is a hobgoblin of small minds, all right? And there are reasons why you decided some of these things. Now, maybe those reasons are gone, okay? Maybe the byword ought to be consistency, but if you're going to be consistent, think about the effect, okay? One of the things I'm really struck by in this conversation is, you know where these two sections came from primarily? Section 1339 and 1341? They came from the Attorney General's office. Is there someone from the Attorney General's office in the room? Why aren't they here? This is the chief attorney for the state of Minnesota who either has no opinion on this subject or doesn't want their opinion known. I'm not sure which, but I'm really puzzled by the fact they're not here. Okay? Now, pending, the issue that Senator Limmer raised, that is a very good issue because pending has that sense of imminence. It's not something where, and this is one of those places where I
always wish there was a
court case. Because when you said pending, you meant something. But nobody ever went to court and tried to establish that pending meant that it means something
other than an attorney
for a state agency saying, well, I think there
might be a lawsuit.
Okay?
Is indeed that what happens?
Yes, that's what happens. However, I'm not sure that saying that that attorney has to make that determination reasonably changes anything. Now, the other reality is, every time you change something in the statute, if we are all to take the Statutory Interpretation Act as what you mean, then somebody's got to say, what did they mean by that change? So if you change determines to reasonably determines, then somebody has to say, you meant that. And what did you mean? So does that mean we're going to have more opinions? And what happens to all of the opinions, as Mr. Neumeister has pointed out, that have already been issued that clarify these points of confusion that have been raised? Do we throw all those opinions and replace them with new opinions? Because there's always going to be confusion about a topic that is this complicated. Okay? So, one more thing that I kind of leaped out at. You are giving, and this is another point that Senator Limmer raised, you're now saying clearly in statute that administrative law judges can make decisions to close data that would otherwise be public to the public. Okay? Now, that may be something you want to do, but don't you want to do it in the Administrative Procedures Act and provide some guidance as to under what circumstances administrative law judges can make that kind of order? But this says that they can do it. The other thing that makes me worried about this is one of the provisions says they can close off witnesses' statements, etc., to the witness. And somebody said, well, part of what we need to do there is to make sure we have due process. But there's no notice that's provided in that language for anybody to find out that's happening to them. Now, how did that language get in there saying that a complainant ought to have access to their own statement? In a moment of strangeness, the Department of Human Rights once said to a complainant, we can't give you a copy of your complaint because it's civil investigative data. Now, one of the things that really concerns me is what you're hearing is a lot of what I call absurd interpretations of the statute. And guess what? We have a statute that says the legislature never intends a result that's absurd. Okay? Now, some people, again, would laugh. I haven't heard any titters here. But part of what attorneys, public attorneys, have to do when they interpret this stuff, and if they do it, and most of them do a good job of it, is they have to do it with that kind of thing in mind. And once you do that, then a lot of the confusion, so-called, goes away. Okay? I appreciate the time you have given me.
Thank you.
See, I've been away for a while. I still feel passionately about the public's right to know and the rights of people to have a certain amount of privacy. And if I can answer one question. Dispel widespread rumor or unrest. It's taken directly from Section 1382. Where did it come from? It came from a New Jersey court case. It was inserted in the statute by one of Mr. Amphenson's predecessors, a woman named Patricia Hurrell, who at that time was the attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. She wanted a little bit more leeway for law enforcement to be able to release information when people were burning down cities and that kind of thing, which is what the New Jersey case is about. So, and if you want to verify that, Pat Hurrell is a professor at Syracuse University and a visiting professor at Harvard University. And you can find her on the web. Thank you.
Mr. Gamberling, you've given us many, many things to think about. And we appreciate that lesson in history, especially someone like me who I'm kind of brand new to this, so appreciate it very much. Now I think we have Mr. Amphenson.
Yes, indeed you do, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Amphenson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. It probably comes as a surprise to some people in the room that I ever had a predecessor, but I'm happy that Don clarified that there was indeed someone before me. I'm identified on the agenda, Madam Chair, as on the con side of this issue. That's really not accurate. My client is neither for or against this bill. What we do want to emphasize today in our testimony is that the bill deals, as you heard, and I think is pretty clearly established now, with some tremendously important issues in terms of data collected by government. You would be hard-pressed, I think, to describe or identify two sections of the Data Practices Act that deal with potentially a greater scope of important information than these two sections of the law. I mean, they extend across virtually every function of state and to some degree local government. So they're profoundly important issues. We do want to also emphasize that current law, as embodied in 13.39 and 13.41, is hardly a model of clarity and comes nowhere close to achieving perfection. So I commend IPAD and the author of the bill for their efforts to clarify these laws. I think that is needed 13.39 in particular has often been one of the swampiest areas of the Data Practices Act and could be improved. And I think parts of this legislation do go in that direction. It's not correct or fair to call this all bad by any means. The two portions of the bill's substance that we are concerned about are the addition of several verbs to Section 1 of the bill, which 13.39 currently extends just to data collected. And as you can see, there have been several additional verbs added on line 6 of page 1. We're not quite sure, to follow up on Don's comments about unintended consequences, what sort of data in this context of investigations may be brought within the ambit of confidential or private data that shouldn't be. The second issue we have in terms of substance arises under the licensing data provisions, specifically the proposed expansion of the law to reach business and occupational licenses. I do think that has to be looked at with some greater scrutiny for this reason, that not all business licenses are created equal. I'll give you a quick example. If a one-person electrician business has to obtain a license, he or she is running a business and gets a business license. But the public interest in complaints lodged against that electrician would be much different than a potential license issued, for example, to a giant toxic waste hauler. And there you could make a very different argument as to how much information about even unsubstantiated complaints the public might want to have access to. I don't think that kind of distinction has been worked through. But again, to conclude, let me say this. Ms. Beyer-Kaprensky and her office have been working with us very actively to try and sort out some of these issues, and we plan to continue to do that. So I am hopeful somewhere there's a solution to this. I just don't think, because of the importance of the topics covered, it can be rushed. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that observation, and I think it's one that I would urge my fellow legislators that we listen to, just in terms of how significant this is and wanting to have had a chance to think through all those potential consequences, because there may very well be, as you said, some good things that we could be doing to make make things clearer, but we don't want to undertake that without really understanding what we might be doing. So I think we have one more person before we maybe have Ms. Beyer-Kaprensky come back and address some questions that I have and maybe some other legislators may have. Jeff, is it Connerly with PCA?
Connell, Madam Chair. Connell, yes.
Connell, okay. Good afternoon.
Madam Chair, my name is Jeff Connell. I'm Manager of Compliance and Enforcement at the Pollution Control Agency. I appreciate you giving me a few minutes to provide the Pollution Control Agency's perspective on this proposed legislation. The Pollution Control Agency does take a number of enforcement actions, collects a significant amount of civil investigative data as it's being proposed here. And also, as you're probably aware, issues thousands of licenses and permits that would also be affected by it. I'm here to offer a few comments related to the proposal. Although the agency doesn't take any specific position on this exact amendment, my first comment is that I think that the Supreme Court has construed the statute. We're trying to operate under what we have perceived it to be. We think that offering some clarifications is probably a good idea. We operate under the assumption that civil investigative data is non-public. I think that using the problematic language of the chief attorney acting on the agency's behalf as closure, we have not used that step in a number of years. We find that we are better able to react to the needs of the investigation and to the needs of the public regarding access to the information by using waivers that people have been able to sign to allow us to work within this structure. I'm not sure that this language offers us anything specifically beneficial and appears to be problematic. Subdivision 2 on line 1.18 of the delete all appears to take what is civil investigative data and make it all non-public. And we support that. We would suggest that there was a draft of the proposed legislation that included the fact that when a settlement is reached, that the data then becomes public. I don't see that in the delete all. That was an important provision, one of the clarifications that the agency would support and would look forward to working with the author on, is something that works towards settlement discussions. Most of our more significant civil penalties that the Pollution Control Agency collects are actually negotiated agreements. Those really don't meet the legal definition as proposed of civil investigative data, but it would be helpful if there was something that included it, because, of course, there is a significant amount of civil investigative data within one of those negotiated settlements. And we do say that if settlement is reached, whatever data was collected along that file would then become public. So there seems to be a piece missing in the definition of civil investigative data. At this point, that was all that I had to offer, and I appreciate the opportunity, and we would be willing to work on the language as needed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Connell. And Senator Limmer, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McConnell?
Just Connell.
Connell. You said you're with the state PCA?
Correct.
And did I hear you correctly that you said that all of your civil investigative information is kept confidential?
As we currently apply, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, as we currently apply the way the Supreme Court has construed the statute, that pending civil investigations are non-public data unless they meet one of the exceptions that would allow it to become public. So the answer would be yes.
And Madam Chair, that's per a court decision?
Madam Chair, that's in response to the Westrum Supreme Court decision and some of the interpretations that were made within it. The Pollution Control Agency became aware prior to that decision, our default was, unless the chief attorney acting on behalf of the agency closed the file, that pending civil investigative data was public. We routinely released information not otherwise protected by statute related to our civil investigations unless we closed the file by memo from the chief attorney. That was reversed for the agency.
Thank you. Senator Limmer?
What year was that?
Mr. Connell?
Madam Chair, if you know. I'm not sure. My guess is around 2005.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Connell.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Beyer-Kopinski, could you come back to the table? I have a couple of questions, and maybe some of the other senators too, but my general observation is that it seems as though this is a pretty substantial change we're talking about, and that quite a few people have some observations about things that they'd like to have, and I appreciate that you have been already working on this and have made some changes, and especially as far as the newspaper, sounds like that you've done a lot to accommodate some of their concerns. With respect to some of these other issues, and especially some of the comments that we heard from Mr. Gamberling and Mr. Anfinson about unintended consequences, I know personally, at least, I don't feel comfortable that I have enough understanding of those things or that there's been enough opportunity in one committee hearing to really work through all of those issues. But just turning to my first concern with subdivision 1 on line 1.5, I'm wondering if you can tell me how this interacts with general discovery rules we have when we have a civil action and we have the obligation to share information between parties to a lawsuit, and whether is this intended to be, this is not intended to take precedence over those rules, is it? And wouldn't we need to have some cross references there? That's one concern I have, is how that interacts with discovery rules. The other question I have is, whether we are going to have some information that would have otherwise been public and that we would want public somehow lose its public nature or public classification once it becomes part of this investigation. So I guess I'm turning back again to thinking about my example of the bridge situation that we have. If we had information that people want and that the public has a real interest in, that would be public information, but now there might be pending legislation, and it wasn't particularly collected for that reason, but it was received, and now it might become part of something. Is that going to turn that information? It would seem to me that there's an argument that it's now turned public information into civil investigative data simply because it was received as part of an investigation. That's just one unintended consequence that I'm wondering if we have to have a concern about.
Madam Chair, the first part, your question about the bridge. The discretion to call something civil investigative data already exists, and like one of the testifiers said, he had filed a notice of claim. So the government was clearly on notice that he was planning to sue them. A government entity doesn't have to declare data civil investigative data, even if they think they're going to be sued, and even if they're doing an investigation like PCA, when they're doing an investigation, you don't have to throw the cloak of civil investigative data over your data unless you want to, and you then, as we've inserted here, have a reasonable basis to believe someone's going to sue you or you're going to sue them.
But Ms. Byer-Kompanski, I don't think that's not what I was asking. It's not a question of whether they have to, but it's a question of whether they aren't going to be given the ability to classify something if they chose as civil investigative data, because you have so many new definitions of something that the public would have been entitled to receive before. And I guess it seems to me that, and the reason I asked about discovery rules is it seems more like what you're trying to get at protecting are things that are more like attorney work product, things that you would do in preparing for a trial that you're generating that you don't want to have to make available to the other side. Or are you saying that if something happens to come if there's a lawsuit pending and the attorney who's handling the lawsuit gets this information, even if it was public before, it's now going to become civil investigative data and it can be classified that way? I guess I'm not quite understanding what type of information you're worried about protecting and how that's going to change.
And Madam Chair, the rules of civil procedure and criminal procedure and the rules of discovery are still always going to trump what this does. But this would allow, say I'm in the middle of a lawsuit and I get a request from a member of the media who would like to be able to see some of this data. It's going to be protected, non-public, and confidential data, so I'm not going to give it to the member of the media when they ask for it. But if the rules of discovery say you have to share this with the other side, then the data is going to be shared in that way. So there's no, I don't think there should be no fear that the rules of discovery are going to be superseded by this or ever have been by this.
Okay, Ms. Byer-Kompanski, is there anything in here that makes that kind of reference? I mean, if we have conflicting statutes, maybe I'm getting totally off on the wrong track because I see Mr. Gamberling is coming back to the table. Mr. Gamberling, can you address this issue for me?
Sure.
Well, there's also the judicial branch is not subject to the Data Practices Act, so they have their own rules of access and their own process that is separate from data practices.
Okay. Is that what you were going to tell me, Mr. Gamberling?
Actually, Madam Chair, Don Gamberling again. This was an issue for about the first 5-6 years of this section. Then the Supreme Court, in a series of cases, basically harmonized discovery with the statutory provision. And among other things, established a court-mandated process by which if somebody says you can't have this because of blah, blah, then the judge has to do a balancing test as to whether or not the data should be released. So it's actually handled in the case law.
Okay. Thank you for
case
clarifying.
Case law is real clear.
And Madam Chair, the current language also allows that balancing test when someone goes to court to say, I want to have access to this data, and then the judge does that review of, is it going to cause more harm? Should I allow this release of data or not?
Well, I have a couple other additional questions, but before we run out of time, I'm wondering if Senator Limmer, Senator Bitsold have anything they want to comment on or...
Madam Chair, let me make a couple of comments here. Mr. Anfinson, pointed out that this area needs clarity. So if we decide to do nothing, we have current law, which is not clear. I mean, it does provide that the chief attorney can withhold data. It doesn't respond to a number of questions as to when data can be released, and the licensing data is still up in the air. Mr. Neumeister, interesting enough, if you listen closely, he said, this has been on the books for 27 years, why change it? But then he's urged us to define what pending means. So which is it? Is it clear enough, or does it need clarification? If we just had to pass laws and never came back to revisit them, we would not need to be here every year. But the fact is 90% of what we do is updating current law. And sometimes we wind up with situations where we say, whatever was intended in 1982 or even last year, if it's not quite clear, if the Attorney General had some agenda in 1982, which isn't, they're not even here today, I don't know what was talked about, and we're not bound by that. I mean, we our responsibility is to make the law clear. And Mr. Gemberling said it's crystal clear. Just go back and read the commissioner's opinions. People don't do that. We have a responsibility to make the statutes clear. And if you can read the commissioner's opinion and say, well, now I understand it, maybe we ought to go and take the very same information that's in commissioner's opinions and put them in statute so people don't have to spend time researching it and they can go to one place and figure out where it is. So if the commissioner's opinion makes it clear, why don't we just adopt the very same information that's in the commissioner's opinions and put them into statute so we can save some people some time? It makes great reading, I guess, but I want to make it clear to law. You asked a question, Madam Chair, or there was a question raised about, I guess Mr. Gemberling asked about administrative law judges, denying access. Well, they may have that authority today. If they decide that information is not going to be released, they may be able to decide that. Certainly district court judges can do that. So I think we have a responsibility to try to make sure that these issues that keep coming up and coming up, why don't we clarify it? And I think that this bill goes quite a long ways in doing exactly that. So let me just – those are my thoughts based on the testimony I heard.
Okay. Senator Limmer, do you have any thoughts or any questions before I get back to
– Well, Madam Chair, members, I've tried to listen carefully to our discussion, and it's been an interesting one to say the least. I do believe there are – realities to the discussion we had regarding unintended consequences. I think that discussing this complex area of law in just a matter of a couple hours is probably not going to be enough to give us clarity of where we want to go. Maybe the existing law does remain a bit murky, but on the other hand, I'm not sure if I'm confident in where we're going. consequences of just the issue of pending and not having it and removing that concept is a major move in a different direction. And I think that has an element of essence to the existing law that we're planning on changing. Chief attorney for a government entity that must make a reasonable determination. I'm still trying to get a reference of what a reasonable determination would be, and I suppose maybe that's not our job, maybe it is, but I think it's something that we're now going to trigger perhaps more cases going to support system that's referred to on subdivision 2A on page 2 on whether that is. I just think that the bill needs to have a little more time and maybe a little more discussion and maybe a little bit more addition to it to clarify it succinctly. And I think that is our job.
Senator Betzold, I agree with you that I don't think that we're bound by something just because it's the way it's been for 20 years. So I certainly agree with that, especially if there are things we can do to make something better or clearer. And I appreciate that's definitely been Ms. Baer Kropinski's intent, and I've worked with her on many of these other provisions, and I know how much she cares about accomplishing that goal. I, however, have to say that I share Senator Limmer's concerns about a couple things he mentioned. I don't like the reasonable determination latitude being entirely with the person that is the one who's most likely to not want to give this information. I don't like removing the pending part of this because I think that means that you could theorize any potential civil lawsuit in the future and use that as a reason, and there'll never be any definite finality that this information becomes public. And I'm not convinced, as Mr. Anfinson said, that there isn't a reason why we should treat businesses and private individuals differently, especially large businesses where they may not have been disciplined, but if you have a pattern of 50 complaints against a business, a large business, and there's I think that's something, if that's been public information in the past, that would be a real significant change to make the public not have access to that information. So I'd like to see the opportunity to continue to work on some of these issues, Senator Betzold, because I think there are some good parts to this, and I think the intent is certainly not that we shouldn't try to improve things or make them better, but I don't feel comfortable the way with those concerns right now. So I guess I just ask for your what you'd like to do with the bill at this point, if you want to vote or if we could continue to try to work out some of these things.
Well, Madam Chair, let me clarify. I don't know if I completely understood. You want to keep the word pending. You're not too crazy about the business license part. What was the other part that you had some concerns about?
The reasonable determination that is basically going to be made by the person who's wanting to keep this information close. I just think that's such a what does that mean? Reasonable determination. As one person did say, we have case law that tells people now what the law we have in place means. And if we put in another ambiguous term or a term that's subject to interpretation, we're going to have, I would think, a whole new body of either opinions or case law or something to define what that means. And so I think we should work on making that a little bit more definitive or some more standards that wouldn't just leave that wide open.
Well, Madam Chair, and just procedurally, as you may know, this bill belongs to the Judiciary Committee. I mean, it was referred to a subcommittee as is typically done, so a subcommittee can vet it. The bill can be brought up and put on the full committee's agenda at any time. Now, obviously, Senator Moore is not going to be interested in having to spend, you know, this amount of time on a bill. That's why we have a subcommittee to do that. But if those were the issues that you have concerns about, those can be, I think, rather easily addressed. And, you know, I can make a suggestion. Ms. Pontius can certainly advise us. But if you look at page 1, lines 10 to 12, if we reinsert the stricken language and then delete the new language on 113 to 115, that initially takes care of the pending issue. I think the word pending might show up other places, like on page 2, line 16, we'd have to go through it and correct it. But I think with instructions to council to reinsert the words pending, that can be done. And then if you have concerns about the business licensing, that's basically Section 7. And if we just strike Section 7, then that reverts to current law.
You might just have to.
Does that address all of your concerns?
And Senator Betzold, counsel is telling me that it would take more than that to address some of the changes that.
Sure.
That would be, if we took out those one sections, there'd be impact on other parts of the bill, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I realize that cannot be done right now immediately, but if those were the concerns, those can be done. And then if those were taken out, we can advise Senator Ma that, at least those issues were addressed. And, now what I don't want to do is to address those concerns and advise Senator Ma that, okay, we seem to have addressed it in the subcommittee, put it back on, and then have new people show up with brand new arguments that they never raised here. That's not fair. Okay, so I'll try to do what I can to make it, address the issues that we've got here, and that's what I can do.
Senator Betzold, I guess I'm just trying to be as accommodating as possible here. I know that Senator Limmer is indicating that there are still some things about the bill, even with those considerations that he's got some issues are some with, and you may be willing to work with him on those issues. I'm not quite sure, though, what we're going to have left of the bill. And I don't want to guarantee that with these changes that there aren't going to be other people or that people are going to be shut out from being able to come back and say, okay, now that you have this, we like it or we don't like it or whatever. So I guess I'm just wondering, I would think that our options at this point would be to either have a vote in terms of a recommendation to the full Judiciary Committee. We could vote have no recommendation instead of an up or down vote, I suppose, pending on what we're able to get worked out. Or we could continue to try to work out some of these things, depending on how urgent this is, so that, for example, if there were some businesses where there's, a sole proprietorship or, a business of a certain size where it would make more sense to me to treat them as an individual, we could include them, but not for the larger businesses. At least that's my personal feeling about it. So,
Madam Chair, it makes sense to me to just lay it over for a couple of reasons. First of all, we don't know how the schedule is going to play out over the next 2.5 weeks. If Senator Moa gets some more data practices bills and wants you to have another hearing at some point, perhaps we could put it back on the agenda and just kind of check in with where we're at. We're not going to take a lot more hours of testimony on it, but that would give us another chance to look at any revised language. It's also possible that if we don't meet again as a subcommittee, but we wind up having a revision of this bill that at least meets the issues that you and Senator Limmer and have raised, we can probably at least advise Senator Ma that we've got something. It'll be her call as to whether she wants to put it back on, and obviously as a bill, she would have to have a public hearing on it, and if she senses that it's going to run into a problem, she's got the authority to yank it off the agenda as well, too.
Senator Betzold, I think that's an excellent suggestion. That leaves us some flexibility, and certainly if we do have another data practices hearing, this is definitely something we will hear again in whatever form we have it before us at that time, and then obviously Senator Ma can do whatever she wants to as well that way. So why don't we do that? We'll lay this over for the time being. And I appreciate not only the time that you've taken and Ms. Byer-Kopensky have taken in accomplishing, I think, what are laudable goals, but also all the information that we've heard from many other people here today and your patience with us who are new to this committee and are really just learning about some of these issues. So thank you very much for that.
Madam Chair, I can't stress enough that if somebody has an issue that was for whatever reason not raised today, I'd rather not hear it for the first time in Judiciary Committee or, you know, when we come back. I mean, we'd like to hear about it before then. So
just for the record, we'll ask that anybody who does have an issue with this get in contact with Senator Betzel
or
Ms. Beyer-Kopansky so that we can attempt to address those things before our next visit to this bill. Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Betzel, I'm sure you're not counting the people that are not a member of the subdivision. Other members may raise other questions that we haven't managed to somehow cover tonight. The one issue that I would like to have addressed sometime in the future is what is the urgency of making this change now? And we talked about it. We kind of skimmed it a little, but I don't think I ever heard an answer to it. And I'm sure that might be a question that might come up if we have any subsequent meetings.
Sure. And Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, as to your first point, of course, I mean, there are four members of the Judiciary Committee that are on the subcommittee. Senator Ma is not here with us today. But, you know, members who either weren't here today or are just not on the subcommittee, of course, have the right and opportunity to raise questions and so forth, you know, when it's heard before the full committee. But the reason why we have a subcommittee is to vet out the problems and the issues. And when we present to the full committee, usually that means that, you know, we're pretty confident that it's good to go. You know, and if it's not, then I think, you know, the committee chair knows what to do then.
Well, yeah. Senator Betzel, I'm sure that Senator Limmer and I will be happy to sit down and go through that with you if we can do that and see if we can get to that point. And now, Senator Betzel, would you be willing to change places with me?
I guess, or have Senator Limmer do it. So.
Okay.
Senator Olson, we have Senate File Number 3235 before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3235 is a bill that has been basically makes some technical changes to data practices, and so it's basically just a technical bill. I do have an amendment, the A3 amendment, which will, I guess, put the bill in the form that I would like it to be considered.
Senator Olson, we're waiting for that bill to be passed out to me, I was wondering if you could maybe explain your amendment.
I think I will ask... Ms. Spraymeyer?
Mr. Chair and members, what the amendment does, in the bill as introduced, there was some language that the reviser underlined as new language that was existing language, so we're just making the clarification. And I will go ahead and explain the overall bill, which this fits in.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay.
You probably should identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lori Barkopensky from the Department of Administration.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Section 1 of the bill deletes references to compiling copies, which is an old-fashioned wooden device that was used for separating copies before there was a little tray at the bottom of our copy machines. We deleted similar references to this compiling machine last year in Section 13.04. So we're doing that same thing. We want the language to be consistent. Section 2 of the bill replaces that longer phrase for the shorthand government entity, as we have done in other years as well. Section 3 is just a grammatical correction to make data plural. And then the last section of the bill corrects an incorrect cross-reference that is in the 260B.171 Peace Officer Records on Children. So it's just a different cross-reference that wasn't caught when Chapter 13 was recodified. So that is the extent of the technical corrections.
Members, are there any questions on the A3 amendment you're on? A2 amendment.
And actually, Mr. Chair, I think what Ms. Byer Kopinski did was she just walked you through the entire bill.
That's
so.
Right. That's right. We were trying to get to the amendment first, but which amendment would you want to move first?
Well, I guess I'd first move the A3 amendment. I'd first move the A3 amendment.
The A3 amendment is an author's amendment in order to get the bill in the order that the author requests. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. And opposed, none. Amendment passes. There's an A2 amendment. Is Senator Betzel?
Chair, I've got the A2 amendment, and I'll need Commissioner Segrin to come forward so I can, because this is a Department of Education issue. Let me explain that this is actually part of a bill, is it a K-12 bill? K-12 bill that's already introduced, and this is a component of it. And but we, rather than risking having the whole K-12 bill come to judiciary and get into deadline problems and so forth, this is the one component. I met with Commissioner Segrin last week, and we discussed this part, and she'll be able to explain, what the background is. But basically, they right now collect data on students in the K through 12 system. It's already been done. However, higher education also, has its own needs, and there would like to have some seamless way to be able to share certain amounts of data, mainly demographic data, not individually identifiable information, so that in the bigger scheme of things, the higher ed system can be able to track how students did in K-12 and correlate that with how they're doing in higher education. And likewise, have information transferred back and forth as, not identifying information, but the data that can summarize to help both systems be able to provide better for the students. But as I say, Commissioner Segrin, can provide further discussion of this and on the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Betzold. Commissioner Segrin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Betzold for that explanation. I think he's covered it fairly well. Susan Hegard is here from the Office of Higher Education. We started a couple of years ago talking about the ability to be able to share the data that we already collect between our two agencies for research purposes. And the research purposes would be to improve the academic achievement of our students, both in the K-12 system and in the higher ed system. And each of our agencies collect a lot of data. We want to restrict the data collection to the four areas that you see before you. So we want to make it clear that this is all we're interested in doing. There were some concerns about other kinds of information, such as school suspensions, mental health issues. We're not interested in any of those issues. We're just purely interested in collecting educational data. For example, we know that if students take certain courses in high school, they seem to do better when they get to college. So eventually we'd like to say, okay, well, if we can collect that data and see if that's true, then we can encourage students to take certain courses and to prepare them to be better students in college. We also want to know if our students, once they get out of high school and graduate and enroll in college, if they actually stay in college. We know that we have some rough data, but we are not able to track it real completely and follow the students. So this will also allow us to see how long it takes students to get through college, or if they drop out. If they drop out, maybe they end up in another institution in Minnesota, but we just don't know because we don't have the ability to do that. We will be taking the existing MARS number. That is our student identifier number that every student receives when they enroll in a public educational system, K-12 system, and we'll be extending that identifier to any student who goes to a public or a private Minnesota college, and we will be able to internally do some of this research so that we can improve the academic achievement. I'm going to let Susan Hegard talk a little bit about, she actually chaired the committee that brought this all together, and she can tell you a little bit about the process that went into this.
Okay. Pardon me, Senator Olson.
Oh, That's fine, Mr. Chair. I was just pointing out that we have just a couple minutes before we have to turn over to Commerce.
Oh, I understand. Okay. Ms. Hegard.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Susan Hegard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Happy to be here, and I can talk really fast. Commissioner Segrin asked me as part of the P16 partnership. It's a voluntary group of all the education stakeholders in K-12 and higher ed. She asked me when she was heading the group up, headed up now by President Brunig, to take a look at this concept of trying to establish a common student identification number. We got a work group together with stakeholders from K-12 and higher ed and worked out the nuts on this thing. And so what the group really felt they wanted to do was not create a new number. They decided to just take the existing MARS number and run that up into higher education. The idea, I think, as Commissioner Segrin is so well explained, is basically to improve educational opportunities for students in high school and in middle school. Right now, we have a very robust enrollment data system at our agency. We've had it for a long time. There's a very robust data system in the K-12 agency, but there's no way for these two agencies to share some very selected information. One friendly suggestion I'd like to make on this bill, it was brought to me when I was testifying on this bill in Senator Pappas's committee, was before the word Department of Education, we specify we're talking about the Minnesota Department of Education. There's concern about us sharing data farther than the two agencies, and I wanted to just be clear about that. We worked through the department administration. We were advised on data practices and FERPA law. This legislation was initially drafted by the folks at the Department of Administration, and we would continue with the Tennyson warnings that we both currently give right now with higher education and K-12. It's been an interesting process, I think. One thing that we wanted to be sure we did in this bill was state that all the data would only be analyzed in the aggregate and summary data and not individually identifiable.
Okay. Senator Betzel. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'll incorporate on page 1, line 6, after the first "the," insert the word Minnesota. I'll just incorporate that.
Senator Betzel moves the word Minnesota to be installed in line 1.6 after the first the word Minnesota. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Amendment passes. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Byer-Kopensky has a comment she'd like to make.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Dean just asked me to clarify that in Section 1, the deletion of the word compiling, just as it didn't last time, doesn't this time change in any way the copy cost that can be charged. This is really just deleting a word that is related to an old technology and doesn't change any of the copy cost structure. So Mr. Dean wanted to make sure that I highlighted that for members in Section 1.
Back of the bill. Okay.
And Mr. Chair, could I make one final comment related?
Yes, Senator Olson.
With respect to the commissioner's sharing of educational data, my concern initially, and I just want to make sure that this is clear to anyone who might be listening, is to again emphasize that we're only talking about summary data. None of this is individually identifiable to a particular person. And so I think that anyone who might have fears about that, we want to emphasize that that's the case.
Senator Olson, I had a similar question that I wanted to ask very quickly. There was a reference that the MARS number would be extended from public education into higher education. Does this bill do that? And so we really are limiting the purview of this bill with the A2 amendment to contain only summary data. And that the MARS number reference really has nothing to do with what we're doing here.
So I would be in favor of Senator Betzold's amendment.
All right. Senator Betzold moves the A2 amendment.
As amended,
if there's any further discussion, either by members or the public, for or against. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? None. Amendment passes.
And Mr. Chair, let me make it clear again, because this is part of a different bill in education, that that bigger bill now does not have to come to the Judiciary Committee, so I guess we'll just have to work it out and figure out where the appropriate places to keep it. At some point, Senator Olson, might be appropriate. Just, you know, you might want to delete this out of your bill, or maybe they might want to delete it out of the other bill, or we'll work it out. So,
Mr. Chair, if I might, when I was in Senator Pappas's committee today, she wanted to wait to find out what would happen in this committee before adopting that particular provision into her bill. So I think if there's interest in having it go into the higher education bill, if there is a higher education bill, she's very open to that. Okay. Thank you.
We'll have to wait till, Mr. Chair, wait till it goes to the full committee of Judiciary before we resolve that issue.
The only other question I had is a reference to the Code of Federal Regulations, Title 34, that's outlined in the A2 Amendment. Does that go in any way beyond the data for purposes of instruction improvement that's listed in lines 9 through 14? Does the federal reference, the Code of Federal Regulations, does it go beyond what the scope of what's listed below in that A2 amendment?
Mr. Chair, no, it does not.
All right. Well, the bill, as amended, is before us, Senate File 3235, as amended. If there's any other discussion, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 3235, as amended, be recommended to pass to the full Judiciary Committee.
Senator Betzel, I thought you said that it didn't need to go to the full Judiciary Committee. Is that
no?
Did I hear that correctly?
No,
I did not hear that correctly.
No.
All right.
Because we're only a subcommittee, we can only make recommendations to the Judiciary Committee, I believe.
What I said, Mr. Chair, was that Senator Pappas had some concern about whether we were going to adopt this language in this bill or whether it should be in the education bill. And the fact is, regardless of what the subcommittee does, it still takes the full Judiciary Committee to make the decision, so we don't have that answer yet.
All right. Senate File Number 3235, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 3235, as amended, be recommended to pass and move to the full Judiciary Committee. Any other discussion on the part of the public for or against this bill? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Bill passes.
Meeting adjourned.
Meeting adjourned, Madam.